Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Colleen J. McElroy. Colleen J. McElroy is Professor Emeritus of English and Creative Writing at the University of Washington and the former editor of the Seattle Review. She is the author of 8 previous books of poetry, most recently Sleeping with the Moon, for which she received a 2008 Penn Oakland National Literary Award. She has also received the Before Columbus American Book Award, 2 Fulbright Research Fellowships, 2 NEA Fellowships in both fiction and poetry, a DuPont Visiting Scholar Fellowship, and a Rockefeller Fellowship. Her brand new book is entitled Here I Throw Down My Heart, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press, which was a finalist for the Milt Kessler Award. Hi, Colleen. How are you?
I'm fine, Jen. How are you?
I'm good. It's really great to have you here in Pittsburgh, and I guess you're going to be reading today from Here I Throw Down My Heart.
Yes.
And go ahead.
This is called Juju Crossings. One of these mornings, and it won't be long, you're going to look for me, and I'll be gone. Which is taken from a Fields song in American Slavery. 1. Street dude says, ain't nothing to it. This mess about job and security. What's social about that, I ask. And the light changes. Traffic racing to the next intersection, to the next beggar with less philosophy and more hunger. They are everywhere, interspersed between construction cranes and traffic jams. Who says we outsource everything? This crop is homegrown and speaks the indigenous language of every train that has pulled away from this town in a dead heat. Help wanted signs littering the tracks behind them. 2. When you ask your son what he wanted to be when he grew up, he did not say, I want to sleep in the street, eating restaurant slop before it cools and the rats come in, before the vermin salt the stew and sanitation picks up the last bit digestible. When you ask, he said only that he wanted not to bring a child into this world where it is cold and scary. And you laughed at his teenage fear. But he has kept his word, shown how easily anyone can slip between the cracks of what passes for civility when all you know is lost in that river befouled with good intentions. 3. Despite yourself, you look for him on every corner behind signs reading, work for food, are hungry, please help. You look quickly, not ashamed, but not knowing where you'll turn if you see the familiar tilt of his head, the sly smile that says, don't look at me. I'm undressed out here among the suits and overcoats. I was headed elsewhere, following a route inside my head that has led me down the wrong street. Don't look. I'm not ready to come back. 4. Rag pickers, the old folks call them. Hobos, bums, a solid parade meandering down the alley, never visible to the street. Bad luck to stare at them, you were warned. When he's lucid, your son can see the horizon, laughs with you until between one day and the next he vanishes to some place you cannot see. Some days you sit by the window, as if by sheer willpower you can make him appear in the broom beneath a bridge or the underside of a freeway. No one is out there by choice, not the street dude with rice cracks ready to put some juju on you, or the old one who takes his time stumbling across the intersection, unmindful of your hurry to go, 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 anywhere away from the smell of desperation, the vague recognition of a face that is all too familiar. Ain't nothing to it, the street dude says, and laughs at no one in particular. Arrivals. You are caught once again in the surreal time zone of truly alien, the crack of dawn with no familiar landscapes, yet a place all too familiar for having been there before, if not there, some other place of almost empty streets. You have come to the place where the ocean begins, a place that held the last glance of Africa before captives were taken to the slave dungeons of Zanzibar. You have come to the place whose name translates to, here I throw down my heart, and you wonder if this is the place where you can begin again. You have been airborne so long, land seems strange. You think of all the hours you gained in flying and all that you will lose upon leaving. At first, you let the wash of tires on the roadway fill the silence. Street lights slap the darkness in regular intervals, while night people take a last breath before they too head for someplace called home. You remember the word for home in this language, if not some other. Here it is, Kwetu, spoken like the whisper of the sea on the last tide out. Someone is burning paper money for the ancestors. Someone else is collecting bottles and tin cans for market sale. The driver makes idle conversation, but you are jet lag numb, and no map you carry will help you track where you're going, much less where you've been. Time is not so simple as having gained a day or lost one. Now you are finally down to earth, still swaying between one moment and the next, trying to get the atomic clock to tilt in your direction. You've lost count of how many cities you've seen from this angle, how many taxis or hired cars you have entrusted with your life on streets that will haunt you 100 dreams from now. You think of those Africans who passed through this place with no hope of returning, the sea a mirror that reflected only sky. The front door of the hotel beckons, and you gather yourself for the next phase. Leave the car with yesterday still stuck to the seat of your pants, your head full of half-remembered phrases studied just for this trip. What stays here? She says, I came here believing bad things happen to other people. Came damn near to believing a good soldier follows orders, and a good girl, she says, steers clear of trouble. Out here, we were told, whatever happens out here stays out here. So I hold back out of loyalty, stupidity, or a little bit of both. I learn to take stock of what moves too little or too late. How many rounds in a standard issue weapon, and who in the end calls the shots that keep us alive. When I ride home, I tell them how many blacks rotated in, and how many Latinas or Chicanas or whatever they call themselves, like it's gonna matter when the deal goes down and you're strung up against the fence on the ground, or just another one of those seven nailed before her tour is over. And I don't tell them nothing is what I expected it to be. And it's what I don't say that counts. How the CO's leathery voice hangs in my ears. And when I pass, he hefts the boys and laughs, points his finger like a trigger when he calls my name. I don't tell them back home how one night I forgot I was caught barefoot looking up at the stars, and how I heard the sound of a belt hasp loosened just before somebody's rough hands found me walking alone, just taking too much time leaving the latrine. And me thinking there must be some kind of blues or country western for what was dragging me down. The same line repeated again and again. Do you like it? Do you like it? Do you do? I'd scream, but nobody comes running when you scream bloody murder and there's murder all around. So I'm left with nothing to do but swallow my spit. What's done is done. Tomorrow he'll shine me on. We'll walk recon to another village. He'll look for roadside bombs. I'll look for snipers. Whatever happens, we're stuck here under strict orders. When I ride home, I'll tell them how the desert looks in the morning, when flares crisscross an oil-soaked sky, and the smell of sex and death fills the air.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Colleen J. McElroy. She's reading from her new book, Here I Throw Down My Heart. Well, that last poem is really strong, and I know that you have a number of poems in the book having to do with women serving in the Army. Mm-hmm. And earlier in class, you said something about someone asking you about your experience in the Army. Can you talk about that?
My father was in the service, so we moved around quite a bit. And I remember seeing women in uniform, but I was too shy or too young to ask them any questions. At one point, I did consider joining the WACS, but I found out they get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I had no intentions of doing that. But I realized, even when I was young, how difficult it was for women to adjust to a male-dominated culture, and it is a culture within a culture. But I do a lot of reading. I read incidental things, and these poems came out of my readings as much as my experiences with my father.
Mm-hmm. One thing I love about your work is how real and connected everything feels. You know, I mean, whether it's, you know, the poem about the homeless man, or it things don't feel at a distance; they feel right there, and mm-hmm. and it's so strong.
Well, I wanted the book to reflect varying degrees of home. Home is an important element in any culture, and whether we stay at home, meaning the place where we were born, or we move around, we're trying to take pieces of it with us.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, the audience can't see the cover of your book, but it's very beautiful and has this great painting on it. Can you tell us a little about this painting?
The painting's by Alma Thomas, and Alma Thomas, who has passed away now, was an African-American female abstract expressionist artist at a time when that field was dominated by men. Well, it more or less still is. But those men, because it was such an emerging art form, didn't have the facility to include artists who were not like them. I discovered Alma Thomas because I'm also a painter, and I love her work because it does not try to do the photographic elements that you see in Impressionist work, but it gives you a sense of the place without having the exacting details.
Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Sure. Recruited. She says after high school, it was this or some dead-end job. So what choice did I have? Twice recruiters chased me across the mall, caught me between cheap clothes and fast food, told me about a good life in uniform until they had me thinking how good I'd look, afro braids tucked under my cap. She says there was no place to hide. Recruiters tracked me down, strolling along like I had time to kill, and going home was the last thing on my mind. We're all family, they said, then dropped me in this detachment with dumb chicks waltzing in acting crazy, like nobody ever sent them running 'cause of the color of their skin. And if you want to know the truth, all of us crazy on dust and blood and how much crap we gotta take before this war is over. And about the time I'm thinking black or white, one body's good as another on the front line, reporters come in to scoop the action for folks back home, and the white chicks pose for the camera, and I'm thinking this ain't family worth a damn. Second tour. On the first leg of the flight from home, she says, I almost missed the plane, going by habit into the men's, thinking I was back in the zone where we all shared the same urinal. And the soldiers traveling in the same deployment look up in vague surprise from buddy talk, the old routine, the joie de vivre that keeps them battlefield ready. When they look up, it is as if with one blink of the eye, she might disappear, her shadow still intact, and in half a heartbeat, they turn back to their own distractions of how close the plane has come to the point of debarkation and how long before one meal tastes like the next and where is it safe to look up at the sky? What is there to say when war singles out neither woman nor child? So easy to forget we don't use the same urinal in real life, she says to no one in particular. And in the silence that follows, no one looks up from their appointed tasks. The crossword puzzle, the MP3, the paperback and the airplane noise. What is there to say when someone is tearing down the house they think should last, war or not? Sweet divisions marking his, hers, ours. Military woman evolution. She says, truth was, the uniform caught my eye first time I saw them walking so proud and tall. Could have been that uniform stood up by itself. Starched so clean it was, and the hat, she says, the hat set jaunty over bangs pressed tight like a roll of half dollars. everything jazz till you get down to the shoes. A dead giveaway because no woman I knew willing to trade in her high heels for brogans looked like a man just stepped out of. Seemed like that uniform left them more man than woman anyhow, and the wives whispered, hard woman, whispered, hold her own against any man, and wondered if their man was ready to take them on. Still, she says, first time I saw them parading like they had suit hangers up under their shirts, I nearly bust out laughing, looking at how stiff they moved, till I figured that uniform let them walk on any side of the street they choose. I was walking on a stretch of wasn't nothing wrong, but wasn't nothing right either, so I signed up for a bunk and a duffel bag and sanitary napkins issued once a month. I signed up 'cause truth was I didn't know which way I was going in that world where folks didn't believe a woman could do a man's job, thought one woman could put a platoon at risk, the men rushing in to save her sorry butt. And I re-upped to prove them wrong. I signed up thinking I'd walk tall in parades, thinking I could show them what I was made of, how I could work a gun steady as a man and hold my own. At least that's what I'd dreamed for more than 20 years, serving my time in quartermaster in armpit towns, never even seen a woman like me before, and the brass not letting us off post except in pairs on account of civilians who copped an attitude when we passed. She says none of it turned me around because I was thinking I was a woman who'd seen more camps than any boy back home and knew rank by the stripes and units by insignias. I even dreamed myself in uniform, but like my mama used to say, dreaming ain't doing and shoulda never crossed nobody's bridge. Still, I stayed moving up in rank, watching the world slide by in slow motion. Grunts got it different these days, going from boot camp to combat in a short stretch. Yet I'm the one greeting them when they return, body bag or walking. I'm senior non-com old school in white glove uniform, time and grade slashed on my sleeve. I'm the one telling them it's not the uniform what makes me proud, but what's in it. And I'm the one to salute them all.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Colleen J. McElroy. She's reading from her new book, Here I Throw Down My Heart. I mean, there's such a range of poems in the book, as you said, having to do with home. But I love the army poems a lot. I mean, I love the feminist voice that goes through the whole book. It's so strong.
Thank you. There's a thing about army and home. My mother traveled with my father, but she always took home with her. I mean, she used the army as a kind of cocoon. So her sense of home was never separated from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that relates to what I was going to ask you, which is I know that you've moved around the world a lot. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. But, I mean, not only with your Fulbrights and your fellowships, but just moving around everywhere, and I wonder how that relates to your sense of home.
I think I have constructed a sense of home that is comfortable for me, in that I'm willing to leave it and return, and I hope return enriched by the experience of leaving. There's a Malagasy proverb, a proverb from Madagascar, that says, enjoy yourself to the fullest, but remain the perfect stranger. So when I'm traveling, I want to enjoy myself, but I want to always be aware that I am the stranger, and I need to act accordingly.
Which means?
Which means observing other senses of what is right and what is not. It means learning the rhythms of another culture.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's influenced your poems, or?
Yes, it has.
Yeah.
Great deal.
And you said that you've been to every
country, except if you use the alphabet as a guide, I've been to all the countries except those beginning with an X or an L. And I'm going to use Xi'an in China for the X.
Okay.
For the L, I don't know why it happened.
You better get to Luxembourg really fast.
I know, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, yeah, Latvia. Because I want to write this essay. Mm-hmm. Where in the L am I?
Great title, okay. We have time for a number of poems. So okay. If you'd read some more.
Good juju, bad juju. In Brazil, the figa, a sculpted fist, symbolizes luck and strength. Say you've been found abandoned on Ipanema beach, dark skin clad in a white bikini. Say even silent, the music echoes all the samba schools. Say you've been found in a compromising position, once meaning naked or nearly, to say nothing of the risk of mistaken identity, the half-baked excuses while one foot pointed to the ceiling, the other anchored to the floor. Say it's luck or bright sunlight. Say you've compromised your integrity, meaning nabbed in the act like some five-fingered shopper, or worse, caught cooking books with no kitchen in sight. Say your bones still ache with the heat of lost sambas, leaving you, poor dear, hair a mess. Or say your immune system is compromised, meaning you're losing nerve or worse, resistance to whatever keeps you drawing breath, some place where the beach meets the sky. Say it's done with mirrors and smoke, salty breezes from the sea as you stretch full length, nothing between you and sand. The Art of War. 1. On the road between Amman and the border, trucks haul their cargo of fuel from the souks of the old city to the war. Blink, and you'd swear this scene came right out of Mad Max, the desert painted in ochre hues that even diesel smoke cannot dim. 2. At Dar Alanda Gallery, the scene is stationed among artworks from neighboring wars. The artist says you need only stand in one spot for more than a minute to see these incredible patterns of pain cast upon the desert floor like so many grains of sand. Life intertwined with death, she says. I simply salvage what is there. 3. Each day the violence spreads, she says, and I take my work from what it leaves scattered on the road to create villages from vehicles that failed on a vagrant right turn or hit a straightaway of oily sand, the flotsam and jetsam turned into a montage of cylinders, spark plugs, and gas lines, families of tire shards and shell casings. 4. Lines lead the eye are diverted. Sand houses, gearshaft temples, palm trees blackened with oil and bodies from the litter of the living and the dead. Upright or oblique, posed as if they've just been plucked from the scorched earth, as if the sky can bring them help not found at ground level. My people, she says, made from the debris of vengeance. 5. We're in the safety of Dar Alanda, a place where artists come from the war-torn north, south, and east. Amman stands quiet on the hills sloping above us. She says how important it is to have some way to mark destruction, how a life, no matter how small, can add strength to the carnage. And with distance, she arranges what is left after the flames have died. So many villages are gone, she says. The afternoon light sharpens silhouettes, and she tilts her head. Look, she says, you can almost see them moving with the sun.
Colleen, before you go on, I just keep noticing that you, it seems like you keep going back to the position of the other, or with your poems about the homeless, or poems about people in other cultures.
Mm-hmm. Or losing your home.
Yeah. Can you talk about your, what drives you to write some of those poems?
I suspect that what drives me is the sense of knowing, that loss of self, that loss of the core, what grounds you, what gives you safety on an ever-changing landscape. And I don't want to evoke pity. It's not that, but to understand how much we fracture what should be a safe place. We fracture it with rules. We fracture it with disputes. We fracture it with simply not understanding one another, simply talking when we should listen. One of the things that traveling has helped me do is to learn how to listen. I remember my first research, I went to South America and I went into a village and I said, okay, I want some storytellers. And can you have them here by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning? And I want to record four of them before noon and then two more in the afternoon. And they let me do that, say that. And then they looked at me as if I would just lost my mind and didn't respond. And I didn't understand it. But of course, it's absolutely the wrong approach. And while I had learned the textbook of research, I had not learned the etiquette of research.
Yeah. Well said. Here we have time for one more.
Okay. Non-combatant. A woman crosses the long road to fetch water for her family, barricaded in the refugee camp. As she walks toward me, she raises her hand to shield her eyes, a gesture, almost a salute. Between us, words are too thin, crumble in the air like dust underfoot. She pauses for half a second, as if to say, "What are you doing here?" In the soggy light that shelters the road, I wonder if she could see me frowning. Her baby is swaddled in a sling of bright colors, and her hair braided like coils on a barbershop pole presses against the tip of the dull black automatic, her only true protection, slung over her shoulder and down nearly to the tucked waist of a faded flower skirt. It's him grazing the top of calloused feet. A baby on one hip, the gun on the other, the new African. After she passes, I wonder how many will forget her beauty and remember her gun.
The poetry of Colleen J. McElroy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.